from my heart, from my mind, from my strength, I will worship you.
1 Samuel chapter 20. Saul was anointed the first king, but he disobeyed a lot. And finally, God decided it's time to pull the plug, and God told Saul that he was no longer going to be king. And Samuel snuck off and anointed this young kid. He poured oil on this kid. It's kind of like the initiation. It's a different kind of a fraternity to have oil poured on your head. But that's what they would do for the kings. Oil being a picture of the Holy Spirit. The word Messiah, Mashiach, is the Hebrew, and it means an anointed one, one who has had the oil poured on him. The kings were seen as anointed ones. Priests were also anointed ones. And so David, at a young age, was anointed to be king, and in God's eyes, in a sense, from heaven's perspective, David is king, but from the people living on the planet, it wasn't yet. Saul's still the guy running the government. We've seen God begin to use David in a big way. Back in chapter 17, we saw the helping the nation with his victory over Goliath, which brings me to a story. There was an archaeologist who was digging in the Negev Desert in Israel, and he came upon a casket that had a mummy. After examining it, he called the curator of a prestigious natural history museum, and he said, "I've just discovered a 3,000-year-old mummy of a man who died of heart failure." The curator was like, "Okay, how do you know that? Bring him in. I'll check it out." So a week later, the amazed curator calls the archaeologist, and he says, "You are exactly right. That's the guy's 3,000 years old. And you were right about the cause of death. He had a heart attack. How did you know that that was the case?" And he said, "Well, there was a piece of paper rolled up inside it, and it said 10,000 shekels on Goliath." That's not a very good laugh. I thought that was a better joke than that, but oh well. So David conquered Goliath, and with each of David's victories, Saul is growing increasingly. See, I have got really bad jokes. Really, really, really bad jokes. There's more. I got a couple real more dandies for you tonight, I'll tell you. As David has each victory, Saul becomes increasingly suspicious, insecure, jealous. I don't know if you've ever been in a situation like that, where just like the better you do, the worse the other person is to you. Has anybody else been in something like that? This is David's situation. This is his boss, for Pete's sake. This is the president of the country, the king. Chapter 20. Jealous to the point of trying to kill him. He's already made several attempts on David's life by trying to throw javelins at him. He's even asked other people to kill him. So we pick it up in chapter 20, verse 1. "Then David fled from Naioth in Ramah and went and said to Jonathan, 'What have I done? What is my iniquity and what is my sin before your father that he seeks my life?'" Now, remember, David and Jonathan are close friends. They're best buddies. They care a lot about each other, and Jonathan is Saul's oldest son. He's the crown prince. Got to keep that in mind as you're reading this story, because Jonathan is the guy who should be in line. He's like Prince Charles. He's waiting for the throne. He's the one who's going to be supposedly king after Saul. So, verse 2, "Jonathan said to him, 'Well, by no means, you shall not die. Indeed, my father will do nothing, either great or small, without first telling me. And why should my father hide this thing from me? It is not so.' Then David took an oath again, swore an oath, and said, 'Your father certainly knows that I have found favor in your eyes. And he has said, do not let Jonathan know this, lest he be grieved. But truly, as the Lord lives, as your soul lives, there is but a step between me and death.'" See, Jonathan is convinced that there's no problem. I would know this. Dad tells me everything. And David's not, he's not so sure about that, because he thinks, he knows that Pop knows that Jonathan and David are pals. He's not going to tell, Jonathan. So Jonathan said to David, "Whatever you yourself desire, I will do it for you." And David said to Jonathan, "Indeed, tomorrow is the new moon, and I should not fail to sit with the king to eat. But let me go, that I may hide in the field until the third day at evening." Now, the new moon. This, there's some really cool stuff here when we learn the scriptures. When we learn all the stuff throughout the scriptures, some of the stuff makes sense that you kind of gloss over if we haven't picked up on this stuff. Now, the new moon. No, we're not talking about a vampire movie. That's not what this is about. The beginning of the month, the new moon, every month, there was a feast. That's kind of what they did in those days. You read about this in Numbers chapter 10. This was part of the regular feasts, regular holidays. Whenever the new moon hit, there was a feast. The head of the family would expect everybody to be present. And David is now, even though he's Jesse's son, he's now married to Saul's daughter. He's now, one of the leaders of the military, so really he should be eating at Saul's table at the new moon. This is a time for burnt offerings. This is a time for peace offerings. It was at the new moon. Peace offerings. And it talks about, he says, "I will hide in the field until the third day at evening." Why does he say the third day? This has to do with the nature of these feasts. We think of having, at least some of us do, I know that there are some of you really good people who are vegetarians and you don't eat meat. I get that, and that's fine. My hat's off to you. I'll eat as many cows as I get my teeth on. I just love meat. In those days, though, eating meat was not an everyday thing. You didn't have your freezer stocked with hamburgers and hot dogs and chicken and whatever you want. Eating meat was a rarity. And with the people of Israel, it was usually connected with a festival, with a sacrifice. The peace offerings that would have been offered at these new moon festivals were a part of a feast. The way a peace offering worked is you bring the animal and you offer it to God, and the priest bleeds it out and prepares the offering and gives God his part, which is the gizzards and the fat and stuff like this, and you toss bad stuff off to the side, and then the family gets to eat all the rest of it. The priest gets his portion because he's like the butcher, really. He has to get paid with something, and so the priest gets his portion. But then we all sit down and have a huge meal with God. That's the concept of this peace offering. It's kind of like we think of Thanksgiving. Big family time. And with the peace offerings, if you look at Leviticus 7, we're not going to go there, but if you did your homework in Leviticus chapter 7, you find out that on the peace offerings, you eat the meat for 2 days. And on the third day, no more leftovers. No more turkey sandwiches for the rest of the week. After day two, you're supposed to burn the rest of it up. Now, we might look at it as a hygiene thing, and it's a good thing they did it because the meat would go bad or something like that. But that was the principle with the peace offering. You could eat for 2 days, and then the third day, you're done. So David says, on the third day, I'm going to hide out till the third day. I'm going to hide out till the feast is over, is the principle. That's what he's talking about. So, verse 6, David says, "If your father misses me at all, then say, 'David earnestly asked permission of me that he might run over to Bethlehem, his city, for there is a yearly sacrifice there for all the family.'" Bethlehem was like 6 miles, 7, 8 miles away, something like that. This is a very possible thing, Of course, sure. So Jesse wants all of his sons around at the table, So that was going to be the idea. For most people, that would be an excellent excuse. But not for the paranoid person. For the paranoid person, he's going to think, "Well, how do I know this is really true?" Verse 7, "If he says thus, 'Oh, okay, it's well,' then your servant will be safe. But if he is very angry, be sure that evil is determined by him." So he's kind of predicting that if Saul gets angry, I'm in trouble. "Therefore you shall, he's speaking to Jonathan, "you shall deal kindly with your servant, for you have brought your servant into a covenant of the Lord with you. Nevertheless, if there is iniquity in me, kill me yourself, for why should you bring me to your father? You know, buddy, we're friends. We've kind of promised to hang out together and to get each other's backs and to protect each other. And if there's something wrong with me, don't trick me, don't fool me. Just kill me and get it over with. But if there's nothing wrong with me, then let's work on this. So Jonathan said, far be it from you. For if I knew certainly that evil was determined by my father to come upon you, then would I not tell you? Of course I'd tell you. And David said to Jonathan, well, who will tell me? Or what if your father answers you roughly? Now David's starting to think ahead. You know, so you're going to go home and ask dad about me. And then what if he like forbids you to leave? Or if, what if he tries to hurt you? Or how am I going to find out about this? And Jonathan said to David, come, let us go out into the field. So both of them went out into the field. And Jonathan said to David, the Lord God of Israel is witness. When I have sounded out my father sometime tomorrow or the third day, and indeed there is good toward David, and I do not send to you and tell you, may the Lord do so and much more to Jonathan. Jonathan is swearing an oath to David. And the idea goes like this. If Jonathan forgets to tell David that everything's okay, may the Lord do to Jonathan more than what David is afraid of Saul about. So he's saying, may God get me, even worse than you could ever imagine dad getting you. May God do that to me if I don't get word to you. But if it pleases my father to do you evil, then I will report it to you and send you away that you may go in safety, and the Lord be with you as he has been with my father. And you shall not only show me the kindness of the Lord while I still live, that I may not die, but you shall not cut off your kindness from my house forever. No, not when the Lord has cut off every one of the enemies of David from the face of the earth. He says, show me the kindness of the Lord. Jonathan promises to tell David what he finds out. But Jonathan has this sense that David is going to be the next king. Jonathan's the crown prince. He's the one who's already got the keys to the car in his pocket. You know, he's already, you know, driven the car a few times. He knows how, he everybody's expecting him to be king. But Jonathan knows that God has his hand on David. And Jonathan is okay with it. I love that. He's okay with that. I find it amazing that Jonathan is willing to hand over what other people think is his right, and he's willing to give it up because he sees God's hand on David. To Jonathan, I like this, to Jonathan, God's kingdom is more important than Jonathan's kingdom. God's kingdom is more important than Jonathan's kingdom. You know what I'm talking about? See, we all have our own little kingdoms, don't we? Our lives, how we run our world, how we rule, control our world, the things that we think are important, and things that we want to see happen. That's kind of like our kingdom. And in Jonathan, it's way more important that God's kingdom comes first. He doesn't care what happens to his kingdom. He just wants God's kingdom to grow. That's a cool attitude. I hope I have more and more of that. You know? Because sometimes the things that I want don't happen. And I need to be more concerned about God's kingdom. So Jonathan, verse 16, made a covenant with the house of David, saying, let the Lord require it at the hand of David's enemies. Now, the idea here is that should David or any of his descendants ever cause harm to any of Jonathan's descendants, then may God have David's enemies get him. Because he's making David a promise. Don't just be good to me when you become king. Because, buddy, I know you're going to become king. So don't just do good to me, but also do good to my descendants. I'm making this covenant because I know you're going to be king. And I just want to make sure that me and my house, that we're going to be okay because we're on your side. And so he's saying, saying, you know, well, may God take care of you if you don't take care of my family. But they're okay with this. Jonathan, again, caused David to vow because he loved him, for he loved him as he loved his own soul. He caused David to vow. they're making this promise again to each other. We're going to watch out for each other. We're going to watch over each other's families. And indeed, when David becomes king, you're going to see this when we get to 2 Samuel chapter 9, which is a couple more weeks from now. We get to 2 Samuel chapter 9, or a couple years, or whenever it is. But we'll see this with one of Jonathan's sons, Mephibosheth. And David will keep his promise. He will keep his promise. Then Jonathan said to David, "Tomorrow is the new moon, and you will be missed because your seat will be empty. And when you have stayed 3 days, go down quickly, come to the place where you hid on the day of the deed, and remain by the stone Ezel. And then I will shoot 3 arrows to the side as though I shot at a target. And there I will send a lad saying, 'Go find the arrows.' If I expressly say to the lad, 'Look, the arrows are on this side of you, get them and come,' then as the Lord lives, there is safety for you and no harm. But if I say thus to the young man, 'Look, the arrows are beyond you,' then you go your way, for the Lord has sent you away. And as for the matter which you and I have spoken of, indeed the Lord be between you and me forever." Now, the idea is this. We're going to set up this little way of doing hand signals, you know, like Mike Socha, you know, doing that signals for the runner to go or whatever, you know, and they do these little signals. Well, the idea is that they've set up this little thing that just in case Jonathan has bad news and he comes back and Saul's got his guys watching Jonathan. Well, he doesn't want to give away David's cover. He doesn't want Saul's men to find David. So he's going to pretend he's out just shooting arrows. And he's going to have a kid with him, and if the arrow's on one side, it means one thing. If the arrow's on the other side, it's going to mean the other thing. And that way, they'll have this way of getting the message across without David ever being in danger. Then David hid in the field, verse 24. "And when the new moon had come, the king sat down to eat the feast. Now the king sat on his seat, as at other times, on a seat by the wall. And Jonathan arose, and Abner sat by Saul's side. But David's place was empty." Now, Abner is the commander of the army. He's like the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He's the head of the army. "Nevertheless, Saul did not say anything that day, for he thought, 'Something has happened to him. He is unclean. Surely he is unclean.'" Now, being ritually unclean is an excusable reason to miss a sacrifice. Lots of reasons for lots of ways to become unclean. So he's just thinking, well, maybe it's just something. You know, maybe ate a bug or something, you know, who knows. "And it happened the next day, the second day of the month, that David's place was empty. And Saul said to Jonathan, his son, 'Why has the son of Jesse not come to eat either to yesterday or today?'" Now he knows to ask Jonathan because he knows their buds. He knows if anybody's going to know about David, it's going to be Jonathan. "And Jonathan answered Saul, 'David earnestly asked permission of me to go to Bethlehem. And he said, please let me go, for our family has a sacrifice in the city, and my brother has commanded me to be there. And now, if I have found favor in your eyes, please let me get away and see my brothers. Therefore, he has not come to the king's table.' Then Saul's anger was aroused against Jonathan, and he said to him, 'You son of a perverse, rebellious woman, do I not know that you have chosen the son of Jesse to your own shame and to the shame of your mother's nakedness?'" He's a little upset. He's saying some not so nice things to his son. "The shame of your mother's nakedness." Jonathan's the next one in line to become king. And when Jonathan acts as if he thinks that David ought to be king, he's disgracing himself as well as his father, because his father expects him to become the king. And here he's giving it all away. His father is the one who impregnated his mother. And so he's saying, "You're shaming me, the shame of your mother's nakedness." He's talking about the shame falling on himself. Some might even suggest that Jonathan was never a legitimate son in the first place. And maybe that's why Saul's allowing this. Lots of different ideas. Verse 31, "For as long as the son of Jesse lives on the earth, you shall not be established, nor your kingdom. Now, therefore, send and bring him to me, for he shall surely die." And Jonathan answered his father and said to him, "Why should he be killed? What has he done?" Then Saul cast a spear at him to kill him, by which Jonathan knew, he knew it was determined by his father to kill David. Okay, gotcha, pop, message received. Now, things are getting pretty bad with Saul. He's even trying to kill his own son. Now, just a little note. It seems to me, if we're like recording this for batting average or something like this, seems to me that Saul is not very good at throwing javelins. Because we actually don't have any record of him actually hitting anyone. So I'm kind of thinking that maybe Saul needs glasses. I don't know, because he doesn't. Okay, verse 34. So Jonathan arose from the table in fierce anger and ate no food the second day. He never didn't stay to eat the dinner, for he was grieved for David because his father had treated him shamefully, treated David shamefully. And so it was in the morning that Jonathan went out into the field at the time appointed with David, and a little lad was with him. And then he said to his lad, "Now run, find the arrows which I shoot." And as the lad ran, he shot an arrow behind him, past him. When the lad had come to the place where the arrow was which Jonathan had shot, Jonathan cried out after the lad and said, "Is not the arrow behind you?" Well, that's the code that says, David, you're in trouble. And Jonathan cried out to the lad, "Make haste, hurry, do not delay." So Jonathan's lad gathered up the arrows and came back to his master. But the lad did not know anything. Only Jonathan and David knew of the matter. Then Jonathan gave his weapons to his lad and said to him, "Go carry them to the city." As soon as the lad had gone, David arose from a place toward the south, fell on his face to the ground and bowed down three times. And they kissed one another and they wept together, but David more so. Why did they go through this ritual? Because they didn't know whether anybody was watching. But by the time it's done, David realizes there's nobody else around, and he comes out to weep with his pal. Bowing down three times to the ground in front of Jonathan, that's not the kind of actions of somebody who's a threat to the kingdom, is it? That's the actions of a young man who is quite respectful to the crown prince. David never plotted to become king. Verse 42, then Jonathan said to David, "Go in peace, since we have both sworn in the name of the Lord, saying, 'May the Lord be between you and me, and between your descendants and my descendants forever.'" So he rose and departed, and Jonathan went into the city. Now, this isn't going to be the last time David's going to see Jonathan. They will see each other one more time when we get to chapter 23. But this is a tough farewell. It says, "The Lord be between you and me." And I just want to talk for a minute about friendships, because that's what David and Jonathan have. They have a good, healthy friendship. Some people try to make weird stuff out of this. Nothing weird about this. These are two men who care about each other, who are good friends. They're good friends, and they care about each other. Sometimes I kind of think that the neighborhood bar is kind of like one of the best counterfeits to what God wants for us in the church. The bar is an imitation dispensing liquor instead of grace, escape rather than reality. But it is permissive, it is accepting, and it's an inclusive fellowship. It's unshockable. It's democratic. You can tell people secrets, and they usually don't tell others or even want to. The bar flourishes not because most people are alcoholics, but because God has put it into the human heart, the desire to know and to be known, to love and to be loved. And so people seek a counterfeit at the price of a few beers. That's kind of what we should have here. The sequoia trees in California, they can be 300 feet above, 300 feet tall. Strangely, these giants have unusually shallow root systems. Is it root or root? Root systems. They root for each other. If you ever saw one fallen over, you'd see that their root systems are pretty shallow. They don't go very deep. They have shallow root systems that reach out in all directions to capture the greatest amount of surface moisture. Seldom will you see a redwood standing alone, because high winds will quickly uproot it because it's so tall. That's why they grow in clusters, so that their roots intertwine, and so that one doesn't fall because they're all standing together. That's kind of what we're supposed to be about. That's what good friends are about. That's what fellowship is about. That's what you see in David and Jonathan. They've got each other's backs, even though they can't hang out together all the time. But they've got each other's backs. How do I find these kinds of friendships? I would love it if you could find it by just sitting here in church. But I got to be honest. I've done this long enough that I know that's not going to happen. You sitting there listening to me, even if there's just, even if you're sitting right next to somebody, sitting in church isn't going to do it. There comes a point where you have to step out. You got to talk with people. You have to share with people. Yeah, you got to risk sharing with people. Got to encourage people. Whether it's getting involved in a small group, or asking somebody to go out to lunch with you after church, or on Thursday night, you know, seeing if somebody wants to go to Starbucks or Yogurtland or McDonald's. Those are some of our favorite places after Thursday nights. Learn to invite people over to the house. Learn to help. Learn to listen. It takes work. It takes work to find people who will get, who will have your back. Had a situation just this last couple of weeks with a person in the church who's struggling with some really, really tough things. And the person said to me, they said, "I'm tired of doing it by myself." Now, just them telling me this isn't gonna, doesn't change anything. It's a step, it's a start, but it's a step in the right direction. Because when you try to handle stuff on your own, man, you're like the big sequoia. Actually, that's a big giant piece of sequoia redwood driftwood. Why? Because it fell over. It caved. Probably growing by itself. We need each other. It's important, Kay. And David and Jonathan are a great, great example for us. Chapter 21. Now David came to Nob, to Ahimelech the priest. And Ahimelech was afraid when he met David and said to him, "Why are you alone and no one is with you? This doesn't make sense. Young man, what are you doing here?" Nob, the word means high place. I don't know if you can see this. David has been in Naiot at Ramah, which is where Samuel lives. A few miles away is here, Gibeah. This is where Saul lives. And just a few miles around the corner here is where Nob is. It's just like 3 or 4 miles away from Gibeah. If you back up, it's just like 5 miles from Bethlehem. They're all in the hills, the cities up here around Jerusalem. It's all real close. And this is where at least the high priest is. Ahimelech is the high priest. He is. I don't know if you remember Eli. You know, the old guy who fell over backward and broke his neck when the ark was taken. The guy who raised up Samuel, that was Eli. Well, Ahimelech is Eli's great grandson. So David comes to Ahimelech. He's on the run because he knows he's got to get away from Saul, and he stops at the high priest's place. And David said to Ahimelech the priest, the king has ordered me on some business and said to me, do not let anyone know anything about the business on which I send you or what I have commanded you. And I have directed my young men to such and such a place. Now, therefore, what have you on hand? Give me 5 loaves of bread in my hand, or whatever you got, whatever can be found. Now, he starts off by telling the high priest, oh, I'm on a secret mission. King has sent me on a mission. Now, that's plausible, because David is one of the top commanders. So that's possible, that's plausible. But David's lying through his teeth. He is lying through his teeth. And David's lie is going to get him and a lot of people into trouble. It's going to be one of the worst things ever. Ahimelech is going to help David without realizing that he's putting himself into jeopardy with Saul. You understand what I'm saying? Ahimelech has no clue that there's a problem between David and Saul. And he hears this lie, and he's thinking, oh, well, I'm a good, loyal Israeli. I will help the king. I will help his captain. I will do this. It's one thing if Ahimelech knows that he might be getting into trouble and he chooses to help David anyway. That's one thing, because at least he's making the choice of putting himself in danger, right? But Ahimelech isn't even given that opportunity to make that choice. You follow what I'm saying? David's lie, he's manipulating Ahimelech because he's afraid that if he tells him the truth, he's just going to say no. But gang, sometimes, I mean, we do this, don't we? We tell little teeny lies to get somebody to do something for us. But gang, it is so much better in the long run to tell the truth and risk them saying no. It's much better to have them say no than to find out that you lied to them later on. And even if it's just a little lie, I got to tell you, I get manipulated all the time. It's not fun. It is not fun. Do you get manipulated? I get manipulated. People will tell me little things, and then you go and you do it, and you go, oh, well, they lied, but oh, well, at least it's done, you know, whatever. But do you trust that person after that? Do you enjoy being around them? Do you enjoy listening to them? I don't. It's like, when are you going to lie to my face the next time, you know? Gang, be careful. Be careful when we start down that road of feeling like we can't own up to the truth and just simply ask for help. Lying leads to trouble. Leads to trouble. A pastor was walking down the street, and he came upon a group of about a dozen boys, all of them between 10 and 12 years old. The group was surrounding a dog. The pastor was kind of concerned that they're going to try to hurt the dog. So he comes over and he says, what are you doing with that dog? One of the boys replied, well, this is just one of the neighborhood strays. We all want him, but only one of us can take him home. So we've decided that whichever one of us can tell the biggest lie will get to keep the dog. Well, the pastor's kind of like floored with him. The biggest lie? Are you kidding me? That's not... And he said, you boys shouldn't be having a contest telling lies. And then he launched into a 10-minute sermon, because this is what us pastors do. He launched into a 10-minute sermon, you know, condemning lying of every sort, and he says, you know, it's a sin to lie, and he ends with, when I was your age, I never told a lie. Let's see, where is it? He says, when I was your age, he says, there we go, I never told a lie, and there's dead silence for about a minute. Just as he is beginning to think he's gotten through them, the youngest boy says with a deep sigh and says, okay, give him the dog. We all have a tendency to lie. We don't have to pretend that we don't. We all have a tendency to lie. And it's not hard to find yourself stretching the truth every once in a while, especially when it doesn't seem like it's going to hurt anybody. David's lie will end up with the death of Ahimelech and 85 priests because of David's lie. Now, it's not like David owns that. I mean, Saul's the one who orders their death. But it started with David, with his lie. You know where Jesus said, don't swear an oath, but let your yes be yes and your no be no? That's the same principle. Because sometimes we have to come up with these ways like swearing oaths to get people to believe us, because no way would they ever believe us unless we promise to pay you $100 if I'm wrong, or something like this, you know. Gang, God wants us to be men and women that people have learned to trust, to tell the truth. Verse 4. The priest answered David and said, oh, well, there's no common bread on hand, but there is holy bread if the young men have at least kept themselves from women. There's this holy bread. Now, he's talking about what we call the show bread, or the bread of the presence. And the idea with this is that every week the priests would bake 12 large loaves of bread. Each loaf weighed 6 pounds. A total of 72 pounds of bread they'd make every week. And on Saturday, on the Sabbath, they'd rotate the stock. They'd pull off the expired stuff, and they'd put in fresh bread in front of God's presence. And then, when the old bread is taken out, it says in Leviticus 24, that bread shall be for Aaron and his sons, and they shall eat it in a holy place, for it is most holy to him, from the offerings of the Lord made by fire by perpetual statute. In other words, the priests were allowed to eat this bread. And it's pretty generally regarded that only priests were supposed to be eating this bread after it had been in God's presence for 7 days. And then it comes out, and then the priests and their families are allowed to eat. But David's hungry, and so he and his men will eat anything. Daniel, is the sound up in the back? Okay. I don't know. Is anybody... have you heard of K-Cups, the Keurig coffee cup, coffee maker things, where you make little individual things? Are you familiar with those? Do they have those at your work yet, or have you seen commercials for them? This is a really cool commercial.
Everybody loves Keurig brewers.
Mm-hmm. I love the dark roast.
I prefer green tea.
Well, I love the hot wings.
What?
That's delicious.
Introducing the new K-Cup 5-Star Meals. All the convenience of K-Cup single-serving drink dispensers with the flavor and nutrition of a gourmet meal. Why spend all that time mixing a delicious salad when you can pour a hot, delicious salad drink in seconds? And who has the time to eat a whole box of donuts? The new K-Cup 5-Star Meals, enjoy an entire box of crullers in a single delicious shot. Turn an embarrassing meal into the best corn dog of your life.
That's a good corn dog.
With new K-Cup 5-Star Meals, you can eat like a king and clean up as a snap. The new K-Cup 5-Star Meals. Choose from salad, tacos, hot wings, donuts, and corn dogs. Or try some of our brand new Supremo flavors.
That's good duck.
Order yours today.
I've just been dying for a chance to show you that. But the point is that when you're hungry, you'll eat anything, right? Well, David and his men are starving. They are starving. That was my excuse to do that. How's that? but if you look up K-Cups on YouTube, you can show all your people at work and say, should we order some of this? So, okay, verse 5. Then David answered the priest and said, truly, women have been kept from us for about 3 days since I came out. The vessels of the young men are holy. The bread is in effect common, even though it was consecrated in the vessel this day. What he's saying is this, is that he's reasoning with the priest a little bit about the bread. Maybe it's not all that special because this is probably, this is kind of important. I think this is happening on Saturday. This is happening on the Sabbath. Because I think this is the day when the bread has been changed. So he's saying it was consecrated earlier in the day, but they've changed it out, so now it's not, well, I'm not asking you for the stuff that's right in front of God's presence. Just give me the stuff that's the old stuff that you guys were gonna eat. So he's saying that's why it's kind of common. In a way, this is the stuff, you know, they're eating the leftovers or something like this. It's just common stuff. Verse 6, so the priest gave him holy bread, for there was no bread there but the showbread, which had been taken from before the Lord, in order to put hot bread in its place on the day when it was taken away. So see, that gives us a clue when we know that the routine was to do this on Saturday. That's kind of important. There's a lesson here that we don't have to figure out. Jesus is the one that figured this out. Why don't you look at Matthew chapter 12 in your Bible. Turn to Matthew chapter 12. Jesus takes this story to talk about legalism and to talk about the Sabbath in particular in Matthew chapter 12. I'm not going to put the whole thing up, but wouldn't mind if you turn to that. Matthew chapter 12 says in verse 1, at that time Jesus went through the grain fields on the Sabbath. So the story that we're going to read about also takes place on the Sabbath. And his disciples were hungry and began to pluck heads of grain and to eat. And when the Pharisees saw this, they said to him, look, your disciples are doing what is not lawful to do on the Sabbath. But he said to them, because, see, they were working. That's what they were doing. They were so such bad guys. They were plucking grains of wheat. And then they have to, you know, roll the chaff off and then chew them. And so that was work. Those bad fellows, they're working on the Sabbath. But he said to them, have you not read what David did when he was hungry, he and those who were with him? And what day of the week did David do this? He did it on the Sabbath. Because that's what the story was telling us, that this was the day that it got changed out, which happened on the Sabbath. Didn't you read what David did and he and those who were with him? Verse 4, how he entered the house of God and ate the showbread, which was not lawful for him to eat, nor for those who were with him, but only for the priests. Have you not read in the law that on the Sabbath, the priests in the temple profane the Sabbath and are blameless, because the priests are doing work, in a sense? Yet I say to you that in this place, there is one greater than the temple. He's talking about himself. He says, verse 7, but if you had known what this means, quote, I desire mercy and not sacrifice, unquote, you would have not condemned the guiltless, for the Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath. Jesus is using this story to show that God kind of cares more about people than he does that they dot every I and cross every T. He says, you should have understood what this means. I desire mercy and not sacrifice. The Jews had taken the law and made their traditions so detailed and so intricate that they made life strict and harsh. And if they were there with David, they would have said, no way, David. No way you're getting any of this bread because you're breaking the law. It's a good thing to think every once in a while about what our motivation is, about why we do things. Do we do things out of love for the Lord and for others, or are we motivated by the I have to do things, the which is kind of behind the sacrifice mindset? We have to be careful here, because sometimes we can stop doing the right things and we use legalism as our excuse to stop. We were talking about this at breakfast this week, for example. And I see this in fellows who I'm mentoring, and I try to get them to learn how to read their Bible every day. That's a difficult task, to get stubborn-headed fellows to read their Bible every day. It usually takes me 3 or 4 months before I get them doing at least 5 or 6 times a week. Now, I imagine if I had a group of women, they'd probably do it like in the first week, probably, right? But not us stubborn-headed men, I'll tell you. And I watch everybody go through these cycles. And first they fight against it, and they can't do it. And there's a spiritual warfare going on in there. And nobody, you know, it's kind of, your flesh doesn't like reading the Bible all the time. And then they start knowing that if they don't read every day, that Rich is going to call them on the carpet when we meet again. And I might even slap their hand and embarrass them or do something silly, you know, to just kind of wake up and, you know, and just kind of force them. And then they do 7 days in a row. Then they do another 7 days in a row. Then they do another 7 days in a row. Then they start complaining and saying, but I'm being so legalistic about this. I shouldn't be doing this because it's legalism. So what do? Do you stop reading the Bible because it's legalistic? Huh? Fellows, do you stop telling your wife that you love her because it's legalism? You know, I don't tell her every day because that would be legalism if I had to tell her every day that I loved her. No, it's called being a good husband. It's doing the right thing. And so the issue, gang, is not stopping things because it's legalistic. Don't stop the behavior. Change your heart. Change your heart. Ask God to help you get closer to Him so that you are coming to Him every day reading because you want to, because you can hardly wait to spend some time sitting at His feet, learning what He's got for you today. Don't stop doing the good things because you're afraid you're going to become legalistic. Oh, no, no, no. Keep doing the right things. Change your heart. Jesus said, I want you to figure what this means. I desire mercy, not sacrifice. Change the motives, not the actions. Verse 7. Now a certain man, so Jesus uses this story. Jesus will use this story to deal with something on the Sabbath and to deal with their legalism. Verse 7. So now a certain man of the servants of Saul was there that day, detained before the Lord, and his name was Doeg, an Edomite. I always want to say dog. He's a dog because he's going to be a bad dog. He's a bad dog. Doeg, the Edomite, the chief of the herdsmen who belonged to Saul. Doeg, his name means fearing. He's a fearful guy. When David is talking to Ahimelech, they're not in the back room counseling. There's people around. And this Doeg fellow is one of the people who's there, and he's watching this. And there's other people around. This is extra credit homework. We don't have time to go there. So if you want extra credit homework, you can read that David will write a song later, after the whole series of events unfold. David will write a song about this event. You can read about that in Psalm 52. We're going to look at a couple other psalms in a minute, but that's extra credit. Verse 8, and David said to Ahimelech, is there not here on hand a spear or a sword? For I have brought neither my sword nor my weapons with me because the king's business required haste. Now, if I'm Ahimelech, I'm thinking, what's with this kid? You know, he forgets to bring the food. Now he finds out he didn't even bring his sword. What is with this kid? That's so unprepared. It's so unprofessional. You know, I don't know. I'd just kind of, if I was the priest, I'd be kind of like, who is it? What is it with this kid? So the priest said, the sword of Goliath the Philistine, whom you killed in the Valley of Elah, there it is, wrapped in a cloth behind the ephod. That's the priestly garment that they use to kind of hear God's voice with. If you will take that, take it. For there is no other except that one here. It's the only sword we got around. And David said, there is none like it. Give it to me. And so off David goes with some holy bread, and a sword, a Philistine sword, the sword of Goliath. Does anybody remember what city, what was Goliath's hometown? I hear a young lady in the back. I can hear her mouth move in the very back. And she said, Gath. Or somebody else said it, but I was just watching my beautiful wife, and I was like reading her lips. She said, "Gap." So, gap. So David, verse 10. He's got the sword of the guy from Gath. Verse 10. Then David arose and fled that day from before Saul and went to Achish, the king of Gath. So he starts out here in Nob. I don't know where's it on the screen. And from Nob to Gath, it's about 25 miles heading west through the hills. And Gath is one of the five main cities of the Philistines. It's on the border with the Israelis, with Ekron, Gath, Ashdod, Ashkelon, and Gaza. He's heading into enemy territory. I guess that's what you have to do when you've got the king of your own country out after you. Gath, one of the five main Philistine cities, and a city known for growing tall basketball players. I can't wrap my head around this. Why Gath, of all places? David was the guy who killed their hero. He killed their cleanup batter. He killed their quarterback. He killed their hero. You would think this would be the last place that he'd want to go. And I'm not quite sure about the bringing Goliath's sword with him as well. I don't know. Sometimes life is hardest among people we should be at home with. And sometimes we can find ourselves being more comfortable with people, with the wrong people. Sometimes it's easier to get along with non-Christians than with Christians. They say, one of the ways people describe it is that Christianity, the Christians, it's the only army in the world where we shoot our own wounded. Need to be careful that we aren't people who chase David away. He runs to the Philistines, verse 11. And the servants of Achish said to him, "Is this not David, the king of the land? Did they not sing of him to one another in the dances, saying, 'Saul has slain his thousands, and David his 10,000s? Remember, we talked about this, you know, back, you know, a couple chapters ago. This was the hot tune on the radio or the whatever they had back then. And this was why Saul got so jealous of David. And apparently the song has made it onto the Philistine radio stations. Even the Philistines know this tune. And even the Philistines see David as being greater than Saul. And they also look at him as being the king. Absolutely fascinating. Now David took these words to heart and was very much afraid of Achish, the king of Gath. He's beginning to wonder if he did the right thing running to Gath. So he changed his behavior before them, pretended madness in their hands, scratched on the doors of the gate, and let his saliva fall down on his beard. He's acting like he's nuts. And Achish said to his servants, "Look, you see the man is insane. Why have you brought him to me? Have I need of madmen that you have brought this fellow to play the madman in my presence? Shall this fellow come into my house?" He says, "Have I need of madmen?" The Jewish tradition is that Achish's wife and daughter were both insane. And so here's David, the people of Gath bring David to Achish to show him off. This is that guy they've been singing about on the radio. And Achish is saying, "Look, I have to live with this stuff at home. What are you bringing more of it in for?" Now, Achish will drive David away this time, but David will be back. David will continue to run from Saul, And one day, he ends up running back to Gath, and he asks Achish for help when we get to chapter 27. Because he doesn't know where else to go. And Achish will end up receiving David warmly, and there's going to be a strange friendship going between the two of them. But for now, David was very much afraid. And David writes a couple of songs. We'll look at them in a minute. He's operating out of fear. He's running from Saul out of fear. He's afraid of Achish. And the Bible does say, in Proverbs 29:25, it says, "The fear of man brings a snare, but whoever trusts in the Lord shall be safe." And I've heard it said, this is a place where I see some people getting quite cruel in their words about David, saying that David is making a huge mistake here. He is afraid. But David will write some psalms here, and he will give you a clue as far as what's happening in his heart. Psalm 56 is one of them. It says, "It's set to the silent dove in distant lands. It's a michtam of David when the Philistines captured him in Gath." That's talking about this story. And it says in verse 1, "Be merciful to me, O God, for man would swallow me up. Fighting all day, he oppresses me. My enemies would hound me all day, for there are many who fight against me, O Most High. Whenever I am afraid, I will trust in you. In God I will praise his word, and in God I have put my trust. I will not fear. What can flesh do to me?" Even though David's afraid, he's kind of clear about who he's trusting. I'm not sure I would call him a carnal man at this point. He's a man who's afraid, he's running out of fear, but he's trusting God. In another psalm, Psalm 34, it says, a psalm of David when he pretended madness before Abimelech, who drove him away and he departed. Now, this is Achish. Abimelech is a term kind of like Pharaoh, kind of like king. This is what the kings of the Philistines were often called, as a title, were Abimelech. And David says in Psalm 34, he says, "I will bless the Lord at all times. His praise shall continually be in my mouth. My soul shall make its boast in the Lord. The humble shall hear of it and be glad. Oh, magnify the Lord with me, and let us exalt his name together. I sought the Lord, and he heard me and delivered me from all my fears." I hate to say that David is in sin at this point because he's living with the Philistines. I don't know what else he's supposed to do. But the one thing is clear, he is trusting God. And I'd have a hard time saying that that's sin. Are you afraid of something right now? I had a couple things this week happen that kind of just struck silly fear in me. And you know what? This is liberating. I sought the Lord, and he heard me and delivered me from all my fears. I can ask him for help. I can put my trust in him. And I don't need to be afraid anymore. Yeah. Let's stand and pray.